I am just so pleased again to introduce Dr. Sonia Hutchins. She is a senior medical advisor in the Office of Minority Health and Health Equity at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Notice they don't call it health disparity, they do call it health equity, and that's awesome. For 2 years, she's also served periodically as the office's assistant associate director for science. Associate director for science or medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or medicine. And is also currently serves as the office's lead for public health preparedness and response to protect and safeguard health of vulnerable populations during an influenza pandemic. She's also a captain in the United States Public Health Service, hence the uniform. And she has won multiple public health services awards, including Foreign Duty Service Awards, Outstanding Service Medal, and Commendation Medal, Achievement Medal. Most importantly, from my heart, she's been serving on the science board for many years, and I am so pleased that she's a colleague and a friend, and she's the one you can credit for this this incredible panel today.
Thank you very much for those very kind words of introduction. I want to at least say what the mission of the Public Health Service is. I think you all may know what the mission of CDC is. But the mission of the Public Health Service is to advance the health of the public through protecting and promoting the health of the public. So let's be clear. This is a service that's been around since 1798. So we're a long time service, and we do have a mission to safeguard the health of the public. Okay, so you're probably wondering, what is this epidemiologist kind of person talking about small sample sizes, right? And I wanted to tell you a little story about that first, and then go through some of the statistics. But I think it's very, very important that we understand these understand statistics very, very well, because it's going to help us solve a lot of problems. There's a lot of advanced mathematical modeling, as Dr. Hubbard discussed, and that we have to be very, very clear about that. And there are people doing this, maybe in academic institutions, but in other areas as well. So we need to be clear about what is going on in terms of modeling and how we could help. Well, my presentation is at the other end of the spectrum, around intervention studies and programs, and wanting to know what method would be useful in helping us understand better what interventions work in vulnerable communities. Okay? Now, the story is that I joined CDC, but before I talk about the story, I don't have any personal financial relationships with commercial interests to disclose, and that the findings and conclusions in this presentation are those of mine and do not necessarily represent the views of CDC and ATSDR. Okay, I joined CDC in 1986 as a Epidemic Intelligence Service Officer, and that is an applied 2-year program at CDC where historically you went out on outbreaks, you tried to find out what the problem was and how to intervene. I liked a lot of action, so I focused in an area where we could have impact. We had highly effective vaccines, so there shouldn't be any outbreaks, really, particularly with measles. But when I came along in the mid-80s, we had a minor resurgence of measles, and there was a lot going on in urban areas in terms of measles, a highly preventable vaccine, infectious disease prevented by vaccines. I had the good fortune of going to Miami, very diverse community even in that time, and found out that a lot of these preschool-aged children were unvaccinated, and they were minority children. So we're like, okay, why is this occurring? What is going on? And so we felt that it was ethical to actually do a small pilot study to try to get at this issue, because the prior set of outbreaks were among school-age children. So now you were seeing unvaccinated preschool-age children, not unvaccinated school-age children, and that was occurring less often. So went into Dade County, Florida, Miami, and did a very small study, case control study, where we had 31 cases, and they were measles, and they were all unvaccinated, and controls who were vaccinated. And we found that those unvaccinated children were more likely to have come from households with single parents, more likely to receive their health care. The mothers were more likely to receive their prenatal care in the public sector, and that, as well as their general health care. So this was really interesting. This was the characteristics of the mothers of the children. Okay, I'm going to go back. So I have another slide I want to share with you. Should be here. But at any rate, we also found, and this is the second slide, that the mothers had no knowledge of vaccines and that their educational level was lower. They were less likely to actually complete high school. So these are all sort of social determinants of health, but these are minority children who were unvaccinated against measles, who came down with measles. And we were not only seeing it in Miami, we were seeing it in New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago. Okay, new type of epidemic. All right. So, I always paid attention to this small sort of pilot study that gave us a lot of good information and watched the literature regarding what was found about these unvaccinated children in urban areas in larger studies. And guess what? They found the same things, right? So, I said, all right, well, we need to look more carefully at these small studies again. And I said, I wanted to know who might be my allies in this, in public health. And I queried some epidemiologists who were practicing in state and local public health agencies throughout the country. And they basically told me through this key informant survey that I did with them, is that currently, oftentimes they just don't have the data they need to make decisions about improving health, right? And that sometimes they have to act rapidly and seek expert opinion, all right, without the data. And that they might conduct a small pilot study if funding is available. And then they said you might as well forget large studies if there isn't any available funding, and they're really talking about federal funding or something like that. They also said that there are a number of factors that they consider in interpretation of small studies. And some of them might do small studies as well. So some of them had some knowledge, and they said, okay, well, these are the things that I would be concerned about, the magnitude of the effect. So if you introduced an intervention or a program in the community, you're interested in, with a small study, if there's a large effect, which we saw during the outbreak in Dade County, then I feel okay that I can make a decision and move forward and intervene effectively. If there was limited time for action and I really had to do it, then I might do a small study. And that the quality of the study is very, very important when you're using a small sample. And the cost and expectations were what drove them to use a small study, and the consistency of findings with other studies was very important. And some of them even said that they would choose a statistical significance level if they're looking for differences, for example, and they wanted to know if the differences were statistically significant, that they wouldn't use a P of, 0.05, they would use one of 0.1, okay, because they, knew the relationship between sample size and statistical significance, the type 1 error. Okay. But they also indicated that they wanted some guidance on this. They thought that if I were to pursue this that and got some guidance, then they probably would use it. So they said, yes, we need some additional guidance on the situation-specific use of small studies, and that the situation-specific interpretation would be needed, some discussion about the magnitude of effect, providing us some easy-to-use tools, and disseminating this information widely to us. And many of these epidemiologists practicing in public health agencies were working with they're members of the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists, or CLU, which is a related organization of urban epidemiologists, large urban epidemiologists. Okay, so in trying to think about this, and I really did have an opportunity to work on this, although I've been working at CDC for 26 years, I had the good fortune of working on measles, and we were able to eliminate endemic transmission, so I advocated for a sort of like a sabbatical to work on policy issues, to do two things, to work on this issue, but also to work on public health leadership. So I went to the UNC at Chapel Hill and got a Doctor of Public Health and Public Health Leadership in the Department of Epidemiology. So I was able to close some gaps at the doctoral level in epidemiology because I had been functioning as a medical epidemiologist. But at the same time, I can look toward the future with public health leadership and all that stuff. So that was really great. But I had to rationalize this a bit to make it, you know, more palatable to more people. So what I did was focus on effectiveness or intervention studies, which I was very interested in anyway, but really look at what the Task Force for Community Preventive Services recommended, and looking at their evidence base and seeing how we can make that stronger. So what I uncovered is that there was this increased interest and demand for evidence-based public health practice. And the Task Force for Community Preventive Services was, leading the way in that area. And they were looking at effectiveness studies as a way of providing key evidence for public health practice. And that the quality of the evidence really depended on their available scientific data, and that the available data depended on resources. So at any rate, so basically couching it around improving effectiveness studies through a small sort of sample size, and concretely, basically, it's going into a community, intervening, but actually knowing that you can use a small sample size to evaluate your intervention, okay? Not only like an intervention and effectiveness study, but even a program that is ongoing. So at any rate, I looked at this issue through starting, and I worked very closely with a biostatistician at University of North Carolina, Dr. Bill Salicito, who actually comes out of a clinical trials career with Quintiles. And so he had a lot of experience in that area. And he was also, luckily, the director of the department of, the department that I was in the public health leadership, and the director of the public health leadership program. So that was really exciting. He was very much an applied biostatistician. But at any rate, we started looking at this issue, and we started with the sample size. And I just want to remind you that the little n, which is a sample size, depends on the z alpha divided by 2, or just which is representing a two-sided type 1 error. And I'm going to go through this. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time. But I just wanted you to know the relationships and what went into a sample size. So it depended on these two errors, and also the variability that you might find, which Alan talked about, or the variance. And then what your parameter, estimate is. Because with sample sizes, right, you're trying to estimate from a sample. Like if you do a census, you technically you don't need statistics, right? But we do, we're concerned, so we do try to get a sense of variability with complete census data. But at any rate, because we are looking at typically proportions, particularly in the immunization world, I wanted to focus on that kind of estimate, like a prevalence, let's say, of vaccination coverage. And we always look at like the difference between populations or the before and after vaccination coverage, or you know, proportion of children and the population that are vaccinated. So we're always looking at differences between proportions. So I really want to focus on that aspect instead of a mean. And so in doing that, there were certain things that were uncovered. But this is like the standard kind of equation used for a simple random sample where you are comparing two populations. It could be your population, you know, before the intervention and after the intervention. And you have essentially an equal number before and after. But at any rate, in trying to address this issue and trying to find out when a small sample size was useful in evaluating public health interventions in communities, what we did was look at data from a real study. And we tried to simulate what statistical inference is all about. And what we did was conduct a study using this real data from a study in Chicago in 1990 through 1991. And we had two control sites and five intervention sites. And this particular study was a it's been called quite, you know, different things, but it was a control community trial with randomization. And randomization was not at the level of the individual. It was at the level of the WIC site, okay? And what we found is the intervention effect at the bottom. And the intervention essentially was assessing vaccination coverage among children seen in these WIC sites and letting their parents know whether they were up to date or not. And if they were not up to date, sending them on for vaccination. We sent them on to the nurse in the WIC site. We put a nurse in the WIC site. Or we sent them down the hall to the pediatric clinic if they were co-located with a maternal and child health kind of clinic. Or we sent them to their own provider outside. And because we've got, you know, similar baseline coverage levels for vaccination and 1 year post-intervention, we decided that we can lump them all together for our analysis and also lump the control groups. Now, what we found is that there was a difference. There was a drop in the vaccination coverage in the control site, okay? This study was done during the end of the major resurgence of measles in the United States between 1989 and 1991. And so we saw a drop there. But in the intervention sites, we all saw improvement, and then the average intervention effect was 14%. Improvement in the children's vaccination levels just by us intervening in those three different ways. So anyway, we did computerized simulations of hypothetical studies using this data, okay? So all this data was in a data set, and we basically, we picked samples out of the data set and did it 2,000 times. But what we varied was the size of that control group, all right? We didn't vary the entire size of the control group and the intervention groups, but we just did the control group first, all right? And in varying the size of the control group, this is something else you have to consider. But it didn't matter when we looked at it. It's called an interclass correlation. Basically, 97% of the total variance that we found was in fact due to the intervention, the differences in the intervention sites, and not due to the clustering effect within a site. All right, so in order to address this major concern with small studies, which is the uncertainty of your estimate, and in this case, the intervention effect, we looked at three different examples of that. We looked at the 95% confidence interval, which it gives you a sense of the precision of how precise your estimate. We looked at statistical power based on the sample size. And it's not really a measure of uncertainty, but it's an important measure nonetheless. And we also looked at the measure of variability, which is called the mean square error. Okay, so these are the computerized simulations. And what we did was do these computerized simulations. We had 2,000 hypothetical studies where there were 30 in the control group and 200 in the intervention group. And we looked at their change in vaccination coverage 1 year after the intervention, okay, for a control group of 30, 60, 100, and 200. And I just wanted to show you this because this is basic statistical theory. I mean, we only pick one sample, and then there's some modeling that tells us what the error might be based on that, right? So here we actually did repeated studies, and this was the distribution of the intervention effect by the control group size. All right, so when you look at the real effect that I showed you, which was 40%, and then we look at the average effect that we found during the hypothetical studies, you see that the line here, which is the real effect, and then the hypothetical studies, the average of those studies was right on the line. So they look about the same, and it didn't really vary by size of control group. Then if you look at the precision of the estimate, the estimates were pretty precise, 1 to 2 percentage points, and there really wasn't much difference based on the size of the control group. And the same when you look at the statistical power. Okay, it was important to have a control group in terms of the mean square, but you see the same, the similarity, and it didn't really matter based on the size of the control group. Okay, so this is just the beginning. We did the control group, but we're also going to vary the intervention group. And we wouldn't be surprised to find the same thing. It doesn't really matter. Okay? In this particular case, because we were looking for the difference between proportions. If you were looking for the difference between means, you might find something different. All right, but when you're looking at the difference between proportions and you're looking for such a large intervention effect, and the study design was one of the best study designs. It was described as having the greatest, the real study, had one of the greatest, were characterized as having one of the, being of greatest suitability according to the Task Force for Community Preventive Services. So study design matters. And if you're going to do a small study, make sure that the design is of high quality. All right, so what do we learn from this particular examination of the small sample size? We learned that there is opportunity to improve evidence-based practice with a small sample size because we didn't see much difference in measuring the intervention effect, the preciseness of that estimate, the statistical power to detect that, differences, and then the mean square error, which is a measure of sampling error and then validity together. And we had, like, we knew what the data showed in the beginning. So at any rate, we believe that other effectiveness studies with a similar design and outcome may be okay to use small control group. And there's guidance on small studies. We could provide some of that. And there was a cost-effectiveness analysis, and you could imagine what that showed, that the small studies, sample size in the control was much more cost-effective. And the control group around 30 or 60 was the most cost-effective. All right, and we're working on user-friendly tools. Okay? And I want to thank you all for your attention and want to stay tuned because there is more to come. And I'd like, again, thank you for your attention.